We're just missing one chair here on stage. Let me start with you, David, since you're standing here. There we go. You're right on my. This has been 18 years coming around. I know Kathy and Frank have been working on it for 18 years. What was it at the point that you came in where you knew you could actually make this film and make it work with the technology now available and everything else?
Just in the last 7 years. About 6 years ago, we started fooling ourselves that we could do it, and that it was ready to be done, and then it was really about, honestly, 18 months ago that we started seeing stuff that realistically we could not see.
Yeah, here comes the chair. What was the key, I know, with you is that you wanted an actor to play Benjamin Button all the way through, that you didn't want seven different actors playing this role, that you wanted, one star to play it. And how did that come about? I mean, how did you make that happen?
I think it's not only, it was not only my wish to do that, but obviously the actor, I mean, I don't think anybody wanted to be part of a series of handoffs. They wanted to, you know, be able to sort of offer the character for the complete journey. So it's twofold. You know, it was, you know, if you start thinking about what seven or eight people can you cast to play the entirety of this guy's life, you know, that's just like a no-win situation.
What's extraordinary, and Eric, when did you start actually working on this this screenplay?
I came into this about 2002, I think. And there had been a history with the problem, so I had a lot of work early on, enough to number other screenplays. And then kind of gave me permission to start from scratch.
And how did you? What was the biggest challenge for you in making this work as a story?
Well, as a professional answer to that, I think everything has to be. I think trying to make it beautiful, I guess, so that it's not such a outrageous fable, so that there's some sense of reality that once you sort of invest yourself into it, that you take the ride for that. Emotionally, it was, I'm just telling you personally, I guess, but both my parents died during writing at this time. I probably couldn't have, probably would have written this without it happening, or should it have. But I think it sort of helped identify myself.
What was the key theme for you?
I think time passing, which is quite part of a lot of my work, that loneliness, probably the happiest thing in the world, but it's something that...
All those big blockbuster themes.
Yeah.
Death, loneliness.
It is time acting. It's just the fleeting nature of time.
I think my favorite line came at some point in the film where he said, you know, I was thinking, you know, nothing lasts. What a shame. You know, that does seem to be something that resonates for me right now because everything is going by so fast.
I didn't write that. But yeah, that's how it feels to me. I have six children. I have a lot of grandchildren. So you know, watching people you love, and then obviously the death of people you love. Nothing seems to last, but I think certain things are permanent.
The whole New Orleans setting. A lot of times in movies, you see New Orleans presented in a different way, but here it's another city, but it's right around Katrina. Now, where did that come into this?
Well, originally, the short story takes place in Baltimore, and we, to be crass, the movie wasn't going to be made, and it was on the recommendation of a production accountant that we worked with who said, you might want to take a look at Louisiana. And so we sent Bill Doyle, who's a location manager now in Louisiana, and he started sending his pictures back, and I would show them to Eric, and he would say, this is actually better. This is the South, and the filigree yet, but in the sense of time, in the sense of, you know, sort of patina of it. And then, you know, I know that when Don and I went down there, we were, you know, around every street corner, there's just some other amazing, you know, carriage house from 1840. You just kind of go, we could actually make a movie here. But then Katrina happened, and I remember when, as we were trying to decide whether, you know, to pursue going back down to Louisiana to shoot, you know, Eric was the one who quite rightfully said, if we make a movie in New Orleans now, the audience is going to need to know whether it's pre-Katrina or post-Katrina. So we sort of said, let's set it in the middle of Katrina.
Wow. And what kind of challenge did that bring to you just in...
Well, the easiest thing in the world when I wrote the exterior of New Orleans was all of a sudden the whole character combined. Therefore, as I said, this whole texture that there's a whole other sense of people that have images of New Orleans. Katrina, I think we would have been terrible.
Talk a little bit about the casting here. Obviously, you've worked with Brad Pitt before in Seven and in Fight Club. Was he your first choice, only choice?
I mean, oddly enough, I got involved. I had gone to hopefully become involved with this project, and then it had gone in another direction. Somebody else was going to direct it, and then this script was sort of flying around, and at one point, Paramount gave it to Pitt for, I think, like the ninth time or eighth or ninth time. And he called me and he said, think about the guy who reached backwards. Are you still interested in that? And you know, I was hurt just now. That's stupid. it was kind of, you know, it was always, I mean, I was going to send it to him, and then when he called me and asked me if I was still interested in it, and then when I got back involved with it, it was sort of a favorite.
And Kate Blanchett's just wonderful in this film.
She's good, huh?
Yeah, she's really good.
Eric and I discovered her.
talk a little bit about Kate.
Well, we talked about doing, in like 2002, 2003, I had dinner with Brad and Kate, and at that time and place, I think Brad was kind of off the idea because he was going to do Time Traveler's Wife or something like that. And I remember feeling like this is never going to come together, it's never going to happen. The three of us went out to dinner, and Kate, you know, started pitching the movie to Brad, and I realized she was as bad as me. So anytime anybody would like lose interest in the movie, I'd say, you should really go out to dinner with Kate Blanchett. She was so eloquent about how she spoke of it. And no, there was never any kind of question that that's who we wanted and that's what we wanted to do, and that came along. And they went off and did that, and then after that, when the movie was moving forward in earnest, those two parts were taken care of.
The whole cast is wonderful. We've gone on all day talking about them. Taraji P. Henson is wonderful as Queenie, and
she's good.
We've got some amazing talents here on stage, and you know, I mean, the challenges that must have gone into this film from your points of view. Let me start with Jackie down there at the end. Hi. The costume design, I noticed throughout the film, I mean, you had a lot to do, you know, going through basically this whole century of, you know, and particularly in dressing Benjamin Button. Noticed in the 40s, he had a totally different look. Obviously, in the 50s, had that kind of Brando thing going. 60s, a little different. Did you base it on stars of the period, or, you know, what kind of thinking went into dressing Benjamin Button?
Somewhat. Had to be the same person through all of the decades. That was the biggest challenge. And he had to be dressed both old and young at these different points of his life. That was a very
in showing the passage of time, which is the challenge for all of you in that. Talk also about Kate Blanchett, because I know you worked very closely with her in designing the clothes she wore, and that great red dress on the gazebo, which looked spectacular.
Kate was wonderful to work with. She's so collaborative, and she loves references. She loves looking at things. And of course, before I started on the character, she just dated everything. Based her dance character on a famous ballerina who was crippled, was very devout, she kind of called Claire. And I know she loved red, and I knew David didn't like red. It's a big quandary, that dress. It was up to Kate. It was up to Kate to sell red. She did beautifully. She said it must be red. Let me show David.
Well, you could have probably changed the color in post-production.
I think he planned to.
Well, it looked right. It seemed like the right choice. And the cinematographer here, the photographer Claudio, is kind of classic Hollywood style in a lot of ways, and muted and dark and not technicolored up at all. I'm just wondering about your approach in shooting the film.
I mean, when I first went to the house, you know, I looked at the house, but the light that was in there, a lot of reference photos. I mean, a lot of when Dave and I look at location photos, we just kind of like what kind of already kind of built into the location, you know, like in the interior of the Button Factory. I mean, the fluorescence you see is what's lighting the place. Tent, the bulbs that are in the ceiling, there's no light. There's actually in the tent seats at all.
It's a very naturalistic approach, then. You're just basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the tent was a little bit tough on that one. But
well, I always find it an interesting thing because, you know, you choose a location based on photographs. And then it always seems to me that, you know, once you get 90 people there, and, you know, four semis, it's like somehow it just doesn't have that same thing, that the reason you went there. So we always try as much, you know, trying to bring as much equipment as you would for a commercial, and try to, you know, take advantage of what the architecture does and how the light bounces.
Now, you had worked with David Fincher basically from the beginning. You've known him for years and years and years, and so
yeah.
You sort of have a secondhand nature of exactly what David's looking for.
Yeah, David's known me. I mean, you know, stage manager to Licorice for Best Boy to Capper, and all pretty much the whole thing since, I guess, 84.
So that helps to have that kind of relationship.
Sometimes.
Sometimes they know too much.
And Don and Victor, the production design of this, did you work closely also with Jackie and, you know, in coordinating everything here?
Yeah, we mostly work closely in working out the palette, just sort of talking about colors and sort of the even tone that we want to keep through the film.
And then Jackie and I had our warehouses next to each other, and we had many kind of little meetings in the back amongst the shelves just to know that a lot of times just by happenstance we were on the same page. And yeah, like.
Now, you know, in terms of the sets and everything, were you very conscious of this whole issue of time here and passage of time and how you decorate these sets and how you bring that about throughout the film?
Yeah, absolutely. The Nolan House in particular was a big challenge always because we were in it for so many different eras, for just about every decade. And as we went on with shooting a lot of a lot of times we'd have to jump back and forth in the same day between the 20s and the 40s. So as David was saying, we had trucks out in the street with whole decades of set dressing on a truck or in the attic of the house. And,
yeah, there's a lot of, okay, we're done with that? Okay, great,
yeah.
Moving on. It's 1954, everybody. That would be great.
But we tried to keep things pretty simple, especially with our changeovers. We realized at a certain point, Victor and I would talk, and we'd say, you know, we do very simple things by changing the window dressing. It still feels like the same place because, you know, often in the South, a home or a location will stay the same for a long period of time, and it'll just be superficial changes to it. So
we wanted to be very cognizant of that and not overstate things and not be too abrupt with the changes.
What was the toughest part of the film for you?
For me or for Victor?
Either.
For me, it was probably just sort of keeping the periods and the time changes kind of straight in your head, you know. And then when we started shooting in L.A. on stage and filming in New Orleans at the same time, and prepping Montreal, sort of jumping around to different places, that was challenging, just from logistics. But visually, you get a film in your head, and talking with David from the beginning and working with him, we did the visibility study several years ago, and knowing what the film was, you get the language in your head, and you're able to move forward, I think, visually with it, without tripping too much.
I think it's always really important to start off by defining things that you're not going to do. You know, like, I mean, you know, we make jokes about no doilies. You know, when you would offer me a picture of a horror, it was like, oh, there's a silver brush on the bedside table, and you're throwing them out the windows, you know. Just because we didn't want to do a lot of the painting references at the beginning were Andrew Wyeth, who paints very kind of austere, lonely, very shaker looking kind of compositions, and so we kind of looked at that and said, well, we have to do something for, you know, so we have to be able to change over and do two decades in one day, and we have to keep it simple.
And what about sound design for the film? Ren, talk about that a little bit.
Well, we were mixing Zodiac, and David called up and said, I need you to start looking for music. And it actually started from music with the first place that he sent me the task, and defining Benjamin Button's piano, because he wanted Benjamin to learn how to play the piano. There's his teacher that teaches him, so that was the first thing that I got set off to do, and trying to find a piece of music that would define him, define the era, just like everyone else here, trying to find all the music for the film in chronology for the right period of time, for the right feeling that fit the mood, fit the feeling of the themes of the film, had loneliness and French Quarter, and whether it was Sidney Bechet or Big Spiderbeck or Louis Armstrong or the Beatles, you know, all these different pieces of music were the first thing that we focused on.
And I think it was also because when we'd gone to New Orleans, even before we started shooting, we were down there for, you know, a month or something before we started shooting. One thing that you become very cognizant of walking around, especially the French Quarter, but almost anywhere in New Orleans, is that there's always music. There's always music, someone coming out, floating out of some window, or being practiced in some back parlor, or, you know, so that became a real kind of part of the identifying of New Orleans.
And have it never stop, you know, when Benjamin meets Captain Mike and they go to the brothel and all the pieces of the cast, and as he travels from place to place, it's constantly coming at us. And in each one of those pieces, we had to find and make sure it was the right moment for that year.
Brad Pitt, I think, has described David Fincher as having the affliction of perfectionism and looking for that exact right thing that makes the scene. And Ken, talk about the editing here. This is not MTV style editing here. It's beautifully
cook.
Yeah, sorry.
I miss it. The office was in the cutting room, was in David's office. It was a quiet, sort of meticulous environment, and you just sort of slowly. I remember the overwhelming feeling of what you were doing when you read the script in the beginning, and went, wow, this is special. I'm just going to stay quiet and hope no one takes it away. But when you're actually doing it, David really steered the ship, so I was privileged to be able to just keep my head underwater and just concentrate on scenes, and it's from shot to scene to movement. And then, you know, towards the end, you kind of come up and you look at the whole film and you sort of stuff together and discuss that.
The other, so like the second 120 pages. But it is one of those things when you read it, it's awesome. I mean, just the amount of things that, because you're trying to imagine, okay, well, he's 22 inside, but he's 73 on the outside. So what does that mean? How is he behaving? And then in addition to that, you're in Russia. And you know, so you have, and I describe it, you know, it's kind of in the editorial process. It's like if you thought about the whole thing, you just couldn't get your head around it. But if you just focused on what the next little block or the next decision or the next thing that you had to get done, you know, it's like they say, how to eat a whale, one bite at a time.
That's what it's like watching it in the audience, too. At first, it seems overwhelming. You're like, grab onto this concept. Can I follow this for 2.5 hours? But then, whatever you did really well because you ease into it so easily, and there's nothing that's not believable, which seems to be the key here to make this credible.
It's also very, if you look at individual scenes, there's no indulgence in it. It's a long film based on its content, but there's no, we're not kind of massaging each other.
You get on with them to decide that.
In my opinion. Yeah, and it was very much worked out in a script format. There's only, I think, one occasion where we picked up a scene and moved it to a different place.
And Eric was really mad about that.
No, I think I came up with it about 6 months ago, and Eric said that was a bad idea, and then he came up with it a few months ago. We did it.
Chilly in here.
What was it?
Yeah, it was the postcard. It was the, It was when Daisy said, was in the hospital, which was when Caroline presented to Daisy that I've met someone and fallen in love. You used to see that as an audience before that actually took place in Murmansk. And it was the only time we kind of preempted something, so we moved it right next to itself. So everything had that same order.
Let's open it up some questions from the audience, if anybody has any. And, yeah, right there. Yes.
Your makeup was phenomenal in there. How much of that was practical and how much was, like, CGI?
Talking about the makeup.
All the aging and everything.
How much of that was?
There's probably, from the time he appears, from the time that Benjamin appears on the boat when he says, you do drink a lot, through finding the motorcycle, that's all silico. That's all prosthetics. All of Kate, obviously, the hospital room is silico, and all of the people that age around Benjamin as he is silico and all this stuff. But the CG is really from the first time you see him. From the time he's in the wheelchair, gets to the cane, gets to two crutches, goes to the cane, then says goodbye and gets on the boat, reads the letter, shows up in Romance. That's all CG.
But what about Kate when she was younger? Because she was flawless.
Yeah, well, Kate's pretty flawless.
She was gorgeous.
Yeah, she has one of those, it's kind of one of those things where I would say, it's okay, we're going to get rid of these little things, these tiny little lines here, and the guys at Lola would say, okay, but we have nothing to track to. Like, there's no other imperfections on her skin to be able to kind of track these meshes. So, yeah, she's touched all the way through till, I'm going to say till through the dance scene in the gazebo, and then after that it's all her, and then we start aging her from the time he sees her in Paris.
Should make it mention the name of the key makeup artist here, Greg Cannon.
Yeah.
Great.
Other questions out there?
No.
Nobody has. Yes, I see. Way up there. It's a little dark in here. Yes, right there.
I thought you did a great job making Brad look very realistic as a small boy, chronologically. How did you guys do that? Did you use oversized furniture? Was it all CGI?
It's all oversized furniture.
And giants.
Front projection. No, it's all CG.
Worked
Thank you. Next.
Wallace, yes, right there.
Yeah, I was looking forward to seeing him as a teenager or a kid as to be really smart and a child that has so much wisdom. Like, sometimes you meet children these days where you look at them and they say things where you think, I can't believe how smart that kid is already.
Me too. Why didn't you do that?
Well, actually, I did to begin with. And then I thought it was sort of a brainstorm. And I said, well, wait a minute, if you're getting old, we're going to assume just, I think, what you're saying, that he's going to have his wisdom. I thought it was more interesting, which is obviously through the life, you start losing your faculties. And you start, what you see now, or forgetful, or whatever it is. And I thought that's, I think it's a great term, a dramatic term.
Yes, right here, yeah.
This question's for how do you tackle a script with 240 pages, you know, like, how do you tackle that in front of a writer? I get lost sometimes with 129, so I'm just wondering.
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't set out to write. I mean, just what size it was. And that's on Warner Bros. Format. That's not normal script.
But come on, you don't feel like you've really written a script unless it's over 210.
Well, I'll tell a very quick famous story about Freud, the movie, and John Sartre was writing a screenplay, and he brought in a 180-page screenplay, and Houston said, it's absolutely amazing, it's brilliant, but it's way too long, and he says, we'll have to cut it, and he said, no, I'll go all the way to cut it, and he came back with a 260-page screenplay. So, I don't know, I mean, page a minute, it's up to this guy. I mean, as long as the directors I've worked with want to make the movies, and I'll give them plenty of material to work on.
It's my fault.
Is there anything you really wanted in this movie that isn't, that you really would have loved to have seen?
No, not really. No, I can't say there is. There was some more kind of extravagance, I guess you'd call it. I sort of went away from the characters. If someone talked about Davy Crockett, I'd show Davy Crockett. It became impossible. The interesting thing is that, and I hope you enjoyed it, but the Lightning Man, everybody wanted to cut that out. They felt that this was unnecessary. It goes to show.
That's me. Mark Evans is here.
No, it's, and you don't, obviously you don't know, it's always, obviously, things watching a movie with an audience, you have no clue what's going to resonate.
It was a weird thing because we had a 3-hour and 10-minute part of the movie. We started showing it to people, and you know, people say, look, it's your movie, you do what you want, but this is the stuff that really worked for me, and this is the stuff that really resonated. And conversely, here's the stuff that I think is utter bullshit and you should get rid of. And so you begin to canvas people, and what you realize is if you kept in everything that was really important to them, the movie was 4 hours long. And if you got rid of everything that they hated, the movie was an hour and a half. So it's kind of like you sort of end up going.
So I mean, I don't know that the issue of time is a tricky one. Wonderful movie that you enjoy, I guess, you know, for a long time. I don't know. The studio sometimes puts sort of artificial, to me, artificial sort of figure you're supposed to reach. And I understand they have certain criteria.
Well, I think if the story holds you and the filmmaking holds you, it doesn't really matter how long or short it is, really, you know. And some movies I see that are 85 minutes, 90 minutes feel like, you know, 6 hours. So it just depends. But this movie feels, you know, I don't even notice time in watching it.
I just thought...
There's the poster.
I just thought it was...
Yes, right here. He's wondering about the tone of the film, how you arrived at it, how you worked together in the...
wrestling.
There's always good creative arguments. Any good director will ask you the right questions. I find, you know, that's like, or a good actor will ask you, why am I coming out of the trailer, whatever you say today. David always asked me why is this necessary. Well, I mean, I just, I mean, sometimes directors just beat you over the head and it becomes sort of a woman relationship, you know.
Yes, yes, right there on the corner.
Something I'm always interested in, sort of this fate thing, destiny, whatever it might be. I'm not sure.
And I've heard you say in the past, too, that it's also about, you know, ultimately, too, just about the people you meet that do put dents in you along the way.
That was the conversation that Kate and Brad, that we had when we were trying to sort of, well, why? Why is anybody interested in this movie? What's the what? And I said, I sort of thought that it was about how we're shaped by those we come in contact with and how we're scarred or dented, you know, the same way that an automobile is at the end of, you know, the character of an automobile is in all the things that the miscues that have happened. And so the notion of that people, you know, it starts with the woman who's cutting his hair and says, you know, we're meant to lose people we love, otherwise how would we know how much they mean to us? And I do think that they are, you know, and I do think that ultimately that's how people are measured is, you know, when they're not there anymore, do they still resonate? Do you still bear the gift of their imprint?
Well, it's been a long journey for Benjamin Button to get to the screen, and it's beginning a new journey today with Finally Out There, and it's an extraordinary piece of work. I want to thank all of you and congratulate all of you for coming out.